And welcome back to Dr. Drill's Making Motivation podcast, where it is our mission to honor the most interesting and authentic people, to tell their stories, and to put some smiles on faces and a little fire under the asses of the masses. My friends, today is Sunday, April 28th in the year 2024, and do I have a motivational story for you? 1-6 Marines, it is my pleasure and honor to introduce Sergeant Rick Suela. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Oberst. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, my brother. It's an honor to have you on here, my friend. We were talking a little bit before we went live, about our time in 1st Battalion, 6th Marines, 2nd Platoon. Talked a little bit about the drill field. So I just want to hear your story, man. So there's a lot of Marines, for context, for the individuals who are viewing and listening. This will be an all audio podcast. This segment of it anyway will be, but we'll capture some video content later. Sergeant Suela, as we called him, all the guys that I've interviewed from the old unit, 2nd Platoon, 1-6, Charlie Company, they're all, I always ask them to recount some stories about motivational leaders and, individuals among our chain of command who they could count on. They felt like molded them into men and Marines, and Sergeant Suela always comes up. So it's crucial to share a conversation with him, find out what he's up to now, and reminisce about the day. So this is your story, Rick. So why don't you start with how you found yourself joining the Marine Corps? Where do you grow up, and how'd you wind up joining the United States Marine Corps?
Well, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I was in high school, senior year, and my girlfriend got pregnant. And I had to find something to save my butt. I looked at all the services, I looked at my family's history, and majority of them were Marine Corps. I had a Marine Corps gunnery sergeant, Ladon, California. I visited him before. So he was my influence to join the Marine Corps. I joined in November of 82 and went to boot camp December of 82. And then graduated February of 83.
Awesome.
And that's how I started my boot camp career.
What was it about this relative of yours, this gunny, that made you think, hey, you know, I want to follow in this man's footsteps? What qualities did he possess?
He just was a leader. He is very... gung-ho, know that word, and he presented himself in a manner that was above everybody else as far as any other services go. I said, I want to be like him, so I did that.
And you're a West Coast Marine, so you went out to San Diego instead of Paris Island, right?
Correct. Went to San Diego, and then Camp Pendleton combined is where they do all their training at. I went there and did boot camp and ITS, infantry training school.
Now, I'm sure you're going to tell us that San Diego is more challenging, more difficult than Parris Island. What do you have to say about that?
Well, like we talked about earlier, San Diego boot camp, they get sent up to Camp Pendleton, California to do their field training. Excuse me. And there's nothing but mountains and hills and all kinds of stuff you can climb out there. So it's not an easy thing to do. It's all mind over matter. But it's more of a challenge than flatland. And that's what Parris Island was.
It's a dry heat, though, yes?
Yeah, dry heat, but you still sweat your butt off.
You know, Parris Island. So then... So you go out there, you go to recruit training, you do your infantry training school out there, and then what happens next?
From there, I went to my first initial FMF, Fleet Marine Force unit, Fox Company 2-1, infantry, of course. And I spent 3 years there, did a deployment to Okinawa, Japan for 6 months under the tutelage of Colonel Peter Pace, which later became a general. I did super squad competition with Fox Company 2-1. We came second in our division, which is, that's a good standing. And like to all you civilians out there, that's the competition between infantry squads throughout a whole division of Marines. And to come in second place is a pretty good standing.
Yeah, it's
you
a
have
big
to
deal.
Extra training. And then you take tests in competition, and whoever comes up top comes up on top.
Awesome. And so that is judged by what? By who's judging it?
Usually it's the like the S3 shop of a battalion. They take care of all the training. So you got like warrant officers and master sergeants that go alongside you, or platoon sergeants from the companies. They're out there with you doing stuff or watching stuff to make sure you're doing it right.
Understood. So then at what point do you wind up, so you're West Coast Marine, at what point do you wind up coming to the East Coast? Because when I served with you, it was out of Camp Lejeune.
That's correct. Back in April of 86, it was time for me to re-enlist. And I had the opportunity to go to Okinawa or Philippines or different places that I didn't want to take my family to. So I decided to go to the East Coast, Camp Lejeune. Upon arrival there, I was assigned to 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines. So, and I was put into what they call the H&S Company, Headquarters and Service Company, where I was assigned to be a company clerk and also a battalion Senko, which is a substance use NCO, to help my fellow Marines stay out of trouble as far as alcohol and drugs.
And what if we could pause there, Rick, I'm interested in that because actually I just spoke to there's a guy who reached out to me regarding the podcast, a friend of mine, friend of his. He was in the Marine Corps, and this was during the Global War on Terror. He was pretty active and I guess tore up physically or mentally or both, but came back and he had some really bad substance abuse problems. And I know recollecting, you know, back in the day, actually probably everybody that I've ever met with that served had a substance abuse problem at some point. And back in the day, it was kind of like, it was what you did. It was part of the culture. You know, you work hard, you play hard, you pull into a port, you come out of the field, you know, with cami paint still in your eye sockets, and what do? You go straight to the 7-day store or a bar out in town, and you start getting tanked up or in the barracks, whatever. So what was that like, and what do you think about the challenge of, you know, I've often thought of it being part of the culture because mostly... The military is populated mostly with young people and primarily young men. And so to balance off that testosterone and to try to kind of like, they got to do something, right? So what do we want to do in our off time? Young men, we joined the military in part because we are not risk averse. We want to get out there and challenge ourselves. We're looking for adventure. We're looking to, you know, to figure out how tough we are and all that shit. So that sends us off to war, but it also sends us off to the bar, and it seems to be part of the culture, like very ingrained. So what was that like being the battalion Sanko officer?
It was interesting because I, like you said, young men want to blow off steam. They want to have to throw a few beers down. Sometimes it gets too extreme. They drink too many beers or whatever they're drinking. But sometimes those young Marines get in trouble. So their platoon sergeants or their officers would refer them to the battalion Sanko, and they talk to the chaplain, and then we decide what the best policy for our best way for them to go was to go to some kind of training, like state top, things like that, to make them realize that, hey, you can drink, but you don't need to get extreme with it. The one I hated worst was doing drug tests with these young guys and finding the guys that were using marijuana or whatever else. That was even worse because a lot of times those folks would get discharged.
Yeah.
Which you don't want to see that happen. We try to save our Marines. We try to take care of them. And that's why we send them to these classes to realize what they need to do, how to calm down. And then some of those Marines, if they got extreme and maybe got DUI or anything like that, they would put these young guys on a drug that would affect them. They didn't even touch alcohol, even aftershave or anything with alcohol would make them sick.
I think that's great, man. I've heard of that medicine, and I think that is great because, yeah, we all know people that we know and love. I mean, I remember there was a guy that was such a squared away, and this is like something out of the movies or something, almost like a Heartbreak Ridge, you know, like somebody who's, they use the phrase break glass in time of war, but, you know, it's part of the culture, Gunny Highway, going out there, killing some beers, getting in a bar fight, going back to the unit, going out on training, being a hero and all that shit. But I remember a guy who was so squared away, but he would, like, on the catwalk, his key halfway in the friggin' door, and he couldn't get in his barracks room because he was so drunk he couldn't push the key all the way in and turn it. He just laid there in the fucking thing. That's
oh my goodness.
That's extreme. That's the sort of person they need to have on that medicine so that they can save them from themselves, you know. But
yeah, it's a shame, and like I said, it's part of the culture, and then you just gotta take care of them guys.
Yeah. No, you did. Well, I appreciate that. I always heard about the Sanko. I remember the term, and you know, I knew it was there. And obviously, if nobody wants to get in trouble or to have any sort of, you know, yeah, like I said, DUI, there's all kinds of trouble that you could get in as a young man, a young Marine, and you say you don't want to be want to try to save these Marines from themselves, and keep their honor clean, so to speak. So, awesome. So thank you for doing that. So you're there. You're at HNS. You're the Battalion Sanko officer. You're serving in 1st Battalion, 6th Marines. And then
3rd Battalion, 6th Marines.
I'm sorry, 3-6.
Yeah.
So then you go off to what happens then? You go to the
I was part of the S2 shop, so I got to work intel and get a secret clearance, and that helped me out later too. So. After that, we were 3-6, we did a deployment to Okinawa. Actually, did deployment to Mediterranean, then Okinawa. And then upon return from Okinawa, I decided, hey, I want to move up in my rank. And to do that, you had to have what they call a B billet. That's like a recruiter or a drill instructor or MSG duty, Marine Security Guard duty, things like that. I had to make a choice, and talking to my career planner, he recommended going to the drill field. So I did that. I volunteered for it. You can either get volunteer or you basically get drafted.
Right.
to that field. I volunteered. So in September of 89, I went to the drill school down at Parris Island because I heard all about the myths about Parris Island. I wanted to see what it was like down there. Went down there in September and graduated December of 89. Went back home to Camp Lejeune, got my wife and child, my son packed up, and we went to Parris Island. Then from 92 January to 92, I did my DI duty, did 5 platoons. I went to the field training unit to train recruits in infantry skills.
Oh, is that like BWT? They call it basic warrior training, and I know that they, after I got after my time, they introduced the crucible and all that shit. But is that when you would do that?
BWT.
Okay.
Correct. The recruits would come out there, and then I'd be in what they call the field training unit. We teach the Marines the recruits all the infantry skills.
Cool, very cool. So what was it like? What was it like? You know, we're talking a little bit before about, you know, everybody's got a powerful, all Marines have a powerful boot camp experience, like Remember When's, you know, because that was when we were broken down and built up. And you can think about the cinematic portrayal of the boot camp experience, recruit training, as in Full Metal Jacket. You know, everybody loves the Gunny Hartman from Full Metal Jacket, and what a great movie. But there's a mystique, right? There's something special about Marine Corps recruit training, and I feel like we all experience it. But then if you have the honor of serving as a drill instructor, that's got to be a real highlight. So what was it like seeing these shoddy young men come in, and you're molding them into the type of characters that can earn the Eagle Globe and Anchor?
Well, day one, when those recruits get there, they got that deer in the headlight look. They don't know what's going on. They say, boy, did I make a mistake doing this and stuff. And our goal was to, like you said, mold them from a civilian puke to a certified U.S. Marine. These kids came down, they're scared. They didn't know what was going to happen. We stick them underneath our wings. We train them, teach them discipline, teach them respect. All those kind of characters. And at the end, like you said, they come out strapping Marines, ready to serve the country. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in training. There's stuff that some DIs can't talk about. And I'm sure you know about that stuff like that.
But, blanket parties?
But not the DIs.
No,
yeah,
no,
yeah,
no.
There's blanket parties that happen. Because there's certain Marines, our recruits, that just don't want to do things right. Right. Some Marine or some recruits that fail to take a shower, they get all stinky, and the other recruits take initiative and get them squared away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all without us knowing about it. And you mentioned Full Metal Jacket. You saw what happened to Private File. So, but we have to keep them under control. We can't let it get out of hand.
Right. And you said you were a third. You said you were the heavy. Is that what the third hat?
The third hat, yeah.
What is
that? That's the one that either you do the education and you also thrash recruits all the time.
Okay.
So you know how you remember you guys do a classroom setting and your GI would just teach you all the information he could.
That's
you're gonna be tested on it.
That's the third hat's job as well?
Yeah. So you did that and you thrash recruits much as you could to get them in shape for their PT test.
Mm-hmm.
Without breaking them, you know. You don't want to hurt them. Because if they get hurt, then things can happen.
So now, what was it?
Go ahead.
What's your synopsis? I mean, what do you think I'm sure both recruit training depots, West Coast and East Coast, do a fine job. But what was your experience like down the drill field in Parris Island?
My experience down there was it's a standard SOP. You know, it's both coasts use the same thing. So they can't alter anything. They can't differentiate from any of that SOP.
Okay.
So they do the same training. It's got the same requirements. It's just on the West Coast, you got hills. On the East Coast, you got bugs.
Okay.
So that's the basic thing.
Like to get a little competition. Some Marines just like to talk shit and, and argue over which.
Exactly. And you see it on Facebook. You see it on the Marine Corps sites if you go into them, that comparing it and saying this one's like this. But it's the same training.
Yeah, man. Well, you definitely brought a lot of those isms. I mean, I'm sure it's just part of who you are as well, but you were definitely a squared away dude when I knew you in 1-6, second platoon. So I always felt like you had those characteristics of the iconic Marine and the drill instructor. You were hard but fair. You were, you know, you taught us a lot of things. You cared at the end of the day. I mean, that's one of the things that I guess when I think about my drill instructors, everybody's got their story of their, you know, their three or four drill instructors and the characteristics that they remember. And of course, these people, it's such an honorable role because you're leaving part of yourself with these young people. You're, you know, like any teacher, you are imparting wisdom and you're showing them the path and holding them on that. And so it's like, you're like a larger than life figure. That's how all Marines remember the best of their drill instructors. But one characteristic I always really enjoyed, I always felt was a great accompaniment to the strength and the discipline was, you know, respect and love in a way, like looking after your Marines, even though especially I can only imagine when you're taking somebody who's this very shoddy raw material and you're molding them and you see the transformation and you see them walk across the drill, you know, for final drill or for graduation, they come up and thank you on that parade deck and their families all around them. It's got to be very rewarding, very gratifying thing to see these Marines that you've just played a crucial role in making them. It's got to be highly, highly motivating. Yes,
it is. It's an honor to train those Marines because they only take the top so much percentage of the Marines that are in the FMF and allow them to be drill instructors.
Right.
I mean, you got to pass a lot of stuff to be able to get to that final point of graduating a Marine. It took a lot of work. And then, like you said, when they come up and shake your hand at the end, it gives you a chill down your spine.
Yeah, man. I can only imagine.
Because you've gone through a lot training that Marine and to get them to that point, to allow them to go to the FMF and to serve his country, it's a lot of responsibility, a lot of pride goes into that. You don't want just anybody to become a Marine.
Right. What are some of your fondest memories? You have any specific memories of your time down in the drill field of
there's
highlights?
Yeah, there was a time, I think it was my last platoon down there, and the first day, the big thing is about keeping recruits hydrated, especially back in July. And then you tell them to go get that canteen and get back online, right? Remember those days?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we just come back from lunch, and these recruits were eating a lot, I guess, and it was time to hydrate them. Go back and get your canteen, come back online now, and they got there, and drink it. And after you drink that full canteen, you hold it over your head to make sure there's no water in it. I said, go back and get that second canteen now. Then we got that second canteen, and the next thing I know, they're drinking, and I've got recruits puking up peaches everywhere. They see, it's like you see one recruit puking up, the other one's looking at it, and they started puking. I said, oh, shit. Had to get that was a bad day. We had to get them cleaned up. And I was there by myself at the time. It's funny. I had one recruit that he said, I can. And he ran out the back door down there at Paris Island. And we were right there by the swamp over there, first battalions. And he'll say he came back. And then he graduated. He's a little short recruit. But he made it. And actually, I think I saw him. He might have been in 1-6.
Wait a second. I'm thinking about as you're telling me this. Is a guy named, was he a dark green Marine? His name Bolden?
No, it wasn't Bolden.
Remember Bolden?
I remember the name.
So he wasn't in second platoon. I wrote a little short story. I call it the Bolden Rule because he was really short. I mean, he might have been 5 foot, and he was dark green Marine. And I remember going to the, whatever street that was, where we would do formation runs along it by the New River there. And, and he would friggin', we did the O course, and he would have to shimmy. He couldn't get the first double bar. He had to shimmy up like the telephone pole on the side just to get to the fucking,
to get to the bar,
to get to the bar. And it was like that all the way. But this dude, and on humps and shit, he would, of course, he was at a major disadvantage, and you see him just leaning forward, and his boots seemed like the size of his helmet. He seemed like, holy shit, this guy is really suffering here. But but the point is, he freaking gritted it out. I mean, mad credit to the guy for being, you know, because he's got a doubly, it's doubly difficult for him to do all the physical tasks like that. But anyway, he just came to
mind. I recently saw a on Facebook, they got this kid that's like 4'7", 4'8", like the shortest Marine ever to make it through boot camp.
Wow.
Down there at Paris Island. Yeah, it's amazing. It may have been San Diego. Mm. Yeah, but there was shit that that had heart, and they made it through all that stuff. There were shorter kids, and they made it through that boot camp.
What do you think what do you think, Rick, about it's something that always really I remember very fondly, is the melting pot. You know, I use the term dark green, light green. That was black and white. And then in recruit training, I mean, I remember vividly there were guys from every segment of the country, you know, all on the East Coast or Midwest to the East, everybody on the the easterly half of the friggin' nation would go to Paris Island, as I understand it. And
anybody west of the Mississippi.
Okay.
Or east of the Mississippi.
Okay. East of the Mississippi. That would have been easier to say. You've got all these people. You got inner city kids, and you got country bumpkins, and you got suburbanites, and all these people that are coming in there, stripped away from all the, you know, all their civilian trappings, and now they're thrust into this experience together. What were some of your observances on that note? People having to work together, a melting pot.
I saw a lot of the East Coast kids, especially like New Yorkers and kids from Boston, things like that. A lot of them kids thought they were big and bad, and they thought they didn't need help from anybody else, other recruits. But as time went by and we broke them down, they started bonding with each other, even the weakest kids, and working together. So they're going to get broken down when you get to boot camp. A lot of, I think they have in their mind that I see like memes that say, I would have went to boot camp, but I would have punched my drill instructor, so I didn't go.
Right.
So yeah, and yeah, okay. But they have a cocky attitude from the East Coast. You're Pennsylvania, right, Obi?
Yeah.
But you're really not considered an East Coast, I guess. Those folks from New York, Boston, they were the troublemakers.
Yeah.
But eventually they conformed, and they became teammates, and they all started doing the training properly, and they all graduated together. One big melt pile, like you said.
That's pretty
dark green, light green, brown, yellow, whatever. They all bounded together and became Marines.
I always love to see to think about that in terms of, like, you know, there's always some sort of social struggles out there with in society, and you know, you, of course, as a former Marine, you look at it through that lens, and like, man, I just remember everybody didn't necessarily get along, didn't necessarily even hang out with each other on Liberty or anything like that, different, you know, black, white, whatever, but you had to work together. And I think that in it, when you break down those barriers, that separation, it just dissolves, and people just realize, hey, we're all human beings, and we need to rely upon one. I love that, I mean, it sucked at the time, right? Everybody was thrust into this thing, and you're like, whoa, I'm completely out of my comfort zone. But when you got to think about the men in your squad, and you're going out on a train.
You didn't see color.
No. It was the greatest thing.
You saw a man, yeah.
Yeah, and it's the greatest thing in the world, you know? And I just wish that there could be a way to extrapolate that to the civilian sector, you know, just seems like everybody's just all for themselves. So.
Yeah, like you said, it's not the color of skin, it's the character of the man or character of the person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So.
And we saw everything. We saw black, white, Mexican, Chinese, whatever, Asian. They were there. We had people like that all the time. We just knew how to treat each other with respect, take care of each other. That's a big thing, taking care of each other. And we became one big brotherhood, a big family.
Yeah.
And that's all the services are like that. But I believe that, you know, working with the Army National Guard and the Marine Corps, that the Marine Corps has it the best. They know their brotherhood part. They know all that. We respect that. We hold on to that.
It's an incredibly strong bond, and it seems to, I guess, as the years pass, I mean, I'm talking 30 years I haven't seen you, but, well, maybe 26 or something like that, but it's been a long fucking time. So, so it seems like the memories ripen even though we lose a little bit of our memory as time progresses, you remember, never forget the guys you served with and the times you had. So talking about taking care of people, you know, let's get to your service at 1-6, because that's the time during that I knew you, and you were really, you know, you're just the guy that everybody that I talk to is always saying, hey, Sergeant Suela, he made a difference. Sergeant Suela gave a shit. You know, he trained us well. He treated us well. And I think that, again, just like the drill instructor thing, how it must be rewarding to know that you're responsible in some way for the making of a Marine, that people remember you as somebody who, you know, made a difference in their life. And to this day, they say, oh, Sergeant Swale. Oh, yeah, Sergeant Swale. You know, who's the guy who, you know, who's a leader that you remember, an iconic Marine from the unit that you would follow? Sergeant Swale. So high praise definitely being showered upon you, my brother. So when I showed up, as I mentioned in the intro, when I showed up to 1-6 with the rest of my guys from Infantry Training Battalion over at
what month did you get there?
So I'm thinking, gosh, it must have been 50 or 100 of us marched through the battalion area on 8th Street in... Because let's see, boot camp was June, MCT was probably September, and then SOI was probably, was that 3 months, maybe? So it was almost Christmas time, because I remember. So we showed up, we marched in with our sea bags and all that shit, came over from Geiger, and there was guys. This is the scene that I remember, men. Marines hanging over the catwalk, you know, coming out of their rooms, looking at us, a duty NCO standing there with the logbook, with the duty belt on, and us being marched by somebody, could have been you, could have been another senior NCO, marching us into the battalion area, dropping us off, and then it started. And I remember being introduced to the different aspects of the chain of command, first the enlisteds. So that would have been yourself and Staff Sergeant Cobbs, some of the squad leaders like Whitehurst and Henderson and others I'm probably forgetting. And then eventually we had a battalion or a company formation and met the Lieutenant Cooper. But I remember, so this, like, it was ominous because, and we knew what we were in for too. We were familiar with barracks life over at ITB and squad bay at a boot camp, but here we are, we're at our job and we're looking at guys like you, you know, people who were, you knew that somebody was a senior Marine because he called them salty. Their camis were worn, but they were serviceable and they were creased and the boots were shined and there was just a swagger in their step as somebody who'd been in, who's experienced and knowledgeable. And so we were the boots. And so it commenced, the assigning of roommates and barracks rooms and the issuing of gear, march over supply, go friggin' do whatever paperwork. And then it was like, it's on. You got your gear. We did PT the next day at like 5:30 or something. And it was, remember Lieutenant Wells or Captain Wells?
Captain Wells, yes. He tried to destroy the guy.
Captain Wells. We're friggin', I remember wearing like gray on gray, like, because it was that cold enough to be wearing sweatpants. So like gray on gray sweats. And we did a company run. And it was like over the river and through the friggin' woods, breaking brush, guys rolling ankles, dirty, bloody, pissed off, bitching. So we go all the way through the woods, and then he would do this shit where he tortured you with like sun gods or just the friggin' push-ups.
I remember them runs to the woods, and one of the other platoon guys, I think Cruz, his name is Cruz.
Yeah.
He had fallen down. I picked him up and said, "Don't let him beat you, Cruz. Don't let him beat you." And he remembered it. He told me one time about that.
Yeah, that's the right attitude.
Yeah, that was the thing back in the day. Well, even now, anytime you get a new lieutenant to your platoon or a company commander to your company, what's the first thing they don't want to do in a PT test or PT thing? They want to try and kill everybody.
Yeah, show you
up. Yeah, and you just gotta have that mentality to beat them. Don't drop out because you just don't want that to happen. So give him the privilege or what's the word I'm working for, Obi?
Don't like it's like Gunning Highway from freaking thing. Don't give the prick the satisfaction.
Satisfaction. Yeah.
Don't give that fucker the satisfaction.
I think I was when you got there. I think I was the senior sergeant of the company.
Yeah,
I think I was the most time in grade and all that good stuff. But I try to be a good influencer. I try to display leadership. And then, did you go to any of the schools like squad leaders course or platoon sergeant course, anything like that?
I did get to go to three schools. I went to the squad leader school, and then I went to close combat instructor school, and then chaser school.
Chaser school, oh boy. Yeah, I did. I did not go to squad leader's course until I got done with my DI duty.
Hmm.
And that usually doesn't happen. So I went to squad leader's course at Camp Geiger, actually, and I was the honor grad.
Nice, man.
I had all my leadership skills. I knew all my infantry skills, and so I got my nice K-bar, and they gave me a sword. And I lost that sword when I got out of the Corps coming home.
Really?
It's somewhere out in the world right now. Someone stole my damn sword.
Of course.
Out of the moving trucks.
Ah, that's messed up, man.
And then I went to a platoon sergeant's course, and I was I came in third place there. Two staff sergeants beat me out. I was still a sergeant, but
nice.
I wanted to know my craft because, you know, that people look at the infantry guy to say, anybody can do that. You'd be a dummy and do that. But in today's world, and we were in, you had to know stuff. You had to know all that equipment we had. And then I didn't appreciate the way people thought about grunts.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. One of the things I've discussed with some of the other guys is there was a sense like your schooling was over, like a select few. Like I felt fortunate that I had a couple schools, you know, and I was made corporal. He sent me over the squad leader school, but I guess there's a lot of envy for the guys that did, you know, like if you go to stay or if you were if you wound up in a reconnaissance unit, they'll send you to this, you know, XYZ school. Everybody gets all this kind of advanced training. Now, we would do a lot of training. You know, we do a lot of hip pocket classes, and a lot of training was ongoing. We're always working on our basic infantry skills, and the basics it can be enough. But I think there's even if some might not want to, I think the majority of Marines and those that are serve would like to have some kind of continuing education. So, you know, they could advance a feather in their cap, you know, get some. So, that's my one of my complaints is like, I would have liked to have seen more more schools available so that guys could, you know, continue to sharpen their edge.
Yeah, that's totally understandable. And I liked it. I got back from two sergeant's course, and we were out in the field. I think we were overseas, actually, doing some training. I wanted to teach you guys how to run a mortar, or a mortar round or two. I don't know if it was, I guess it was you guys. I could be confused, but I wanted you guys to know about that. What happens if a mortar team got hit and the mortar's still there and you guys could use it?
Right.
So I tried to get you guys as much knowledge as you could about the weapons and different stuff. I just wanted to be a good leader to you guys and take care of you. And, you know, I miss the camaraderie now. That's the one thing we always had is camaraderie.
Oh, yeah.
With all the guys. There's still a lot of guys that I wish I had contact with. I haven't talked to Henderson in a long time. Seen him.
Yeah, he's awesome. I was just talking to him last week, I think it was. I'm trying to get him on here. But, yeah, I saw him in the couple pictures that I had combed through trying to find a good, you know, some images to put on the podcast here. I see you and General Mundy. I guess you said that might have been Italy, and then Henderson's in the background. So that must have been your first pump, or the first float.
Yeah, the first float with 1-6.
Yeah, Mundy's...
Mundy's
pretty well respected commandant. Who do you think the best commandant was? Is
as far as what I served under?
Yeah.
I liked General Gray.
Yeah, he's.
You remember Al Gray?
Yeah, he's a pretty famous dude. Yeah.
Yeah, so I liked him pretty much, and then Mundy was good. I served under some good ones.
I think
I can't remember all.
Of was Krulak? He was one of the, he might have been who he was in command maybe when I was there, General Krulak.
I remember Krulak's name, yeah.
Yeah.
He's probably after I left. I got out of Corps in 95.
How many years was that? How many years were you in there?
I was almost 13 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I can remember it like it was yesterday, some aspects of it, you know, like standing in formation in front of the barracks, or gathering up in the second deck lounge for some sort of brief before we're going to do a field training op or something like that, or all the pre-deployment shit we did, blue-green.
Yeah, blue-green workups, all that.
Yeah.
I mean, people just don't know what we've been through, you know, as far as the Corps goes, things you do.
Yeah.
To serve your country, to be ready at a moment's notice to go do what we have to do.
Yeah, it's pretty special, the memories. And that you know, I only did 4 years. You're doing 13, and you're still serving in the Guard. So.
Some capacity, yeah.
So what do you remember about 2nd Platoon?
2nd Platoon... Your platoon or the platoon I had before that one?
No. You were, I remember you. No, so 2nd Platoon, 2nd Platoon Charlie Company, man, 93 to 90, yep. 95.
I remember you guys, a bunch of young strappers. We had a good time. We did PT good. We did our little, we played football sometimes. We did play that one game that I liked with the soccer ball sometimes out there. You remember playing that game?
What is it, like kill the man with the ball or some shit?
It was a soccer ball. We had a soccer ball, but your goal was to get it. You catch the ball and only take like 3 steps, and you had to get rid of the ball and get down the line. But it kept us in shape a little bit. I enjoyed it. I remember all the squads. The only thing, when I was in my first cruise with 1-6, we were all in the same berthing area.
Right.
That second cruise, you guys had that one that was down, a berthing area down below, and the sergeant stayed up top. You remember that?
I do remember that.
Yeah, so we didn't get a lot of berthing time together. But I guess you guys had it pretty good on that one, on that Ponce, though, because the berthing areas for the helicopter ships, They were amongst the whole company was down there.
Really?
Yeah, you had the whole company down in one birthing area. It was a cluster.
Oh, but, Jesus. Yeah, I'm glad.
You guys had a pretty decent that one. Yeah, I remember a lot of you guys still, you and who's the one that made that? I made him carry a rock.
Yeah. I want to get to that. That was so that was friggin' Oster.
Oster, that's it. Yeah, Oster.
Presley was, yeah. I was talking with Presley and Nunn and Gates. And Gates said something. Yeah, Gates said that he said you pointed off in the distance, said take this rock, no, run down to that pole or run down all the way down.
And bring me back a bigger rock. And I can't remember that, but Gates remembered it. And see, I'm saying that's what I like about the podcast you're doing, Obi. It refreshing my memories.
Yeah, man. So he had that, and then friggin' Presley.
Oster,
yeah. Something like he had to carry around a rock because he misplaced something. He had to carry around a rock.
During the whole CAC, we did that. And it kind of had my DI mentality come out to play games. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
But with Gates, I told him, like he said, either NJP or you deal with me. And he said, I'll take you.
There's something to be said for handling things in house, you know.
Yeah, I didn't want to get you guys in trouble. And if you did something totally stupid, fine. But I remember Riley.
Mm-hmm.
He left on a 96 or a 72, and he went out of boundaries. He went all the way home to St. Louis area or Stuyvesant. So I chewed his ass pretty good when he got back. He said he always remembers that.
Yeah, everybody did that shit. I remember they had a map, and they're like 300 miles is as far as you can go or whatever, and guys are swooping. Guys are swooping all over the freaking place.
My goal, I did not want to get you guys in trouble unless it was something totally unprofessional or just violated the UCMJ. There's no sense ruining a Marine's career by something petty like that.
No.
That's always been my mentality. I wouldn't want somebody to do something like that to me either. So.
No, certainly not. I remember, they had the under Captain Wells or whatever the first sergeant was, whoever was running it. A lot of the office hours went out. They had the first place, I think it was H Street.
H Street.
There was a big frickin' oak tree and that they had cut down or it blew over in a hurricane or something. And they had all the guys that had fucked up. They had them, with shovels and picks and stuff like that, trying to get the root system out of the ground there. And that was how they, remember a big dust bowl, they'd be over there working on the tree. And this first sergeant thought that was, but hey, like you said, it's better than, I mean, look, I can't even imagine the being a senior enlisted or an officer and having to spend your time, you know, chasing after people about bounce checks and DUIs and shit like that. It's got to be the least favorite part of their job. And there's got to be some kind of consequences for things. But, you know, you want to, it's part of the, it is unfortunately part of the deal. Again, young men do young men shit. They want to go out there and fight and, you know, pick up some ladies and cut loose, drink beer and all that shit. So there's a lot of that we did. And some of the best times of my life, I remember around that barracks, you know, hanging out with the boys and going out to whatever, bars or whatever and carrying on. But
yeah, and unfortunately, I didn't get to spend a lot of time with you guys doing that stuff.
Yes, that's probably for the best, Rick. But as I said earlier, the term is brown bagger. So you were a married man with children and a lot of the guys, the young Marines that that I served with, like Williamson and Hickman, Burns, they all had families, young families, and you had been where they were. So I always observed that, you know, your advocacy for these guys to make sure that they got cut loose as soon as possible so they'd go home to their families and make sure that they maintain the integrity of that. Because I'm sure, because you understood the gravity of that, you know, and how we would be back.
That's because when I was a young Marine, I did get held over. I did get challenged to stay and help clean the barracks and all that stuff. And I said, man, when I get a little seniority, I'm not going to make my men do that.
Yeah.
They got their own house. They got their own houses to clean, stuff like that.
Now, do you remember the time, I mentioned this on a podcast when you came up. I said, it was one of those moments for the non-brown bagger Marines where we were playing games around field day, and the gunny, I think it was Gunny Holmes. I don't know if you remember him, but he was a dark green, big muscular guy with gold teeth.
Yep.
And he, that was one of the things. If he failed, if your room failed, or that means your platoon failed, then nobody's going on this 96. And I was just, he had tried to hold up our liberty. We had a 72 or a 96 or something coming out that Friday, and it was Thursday night, and he's like, nobody's going anywhere. And I just fucking lost it because, you know, typically non-rate Marine, I was probably PFC or a Lance Corporal, and I'm beside myself because I want to go home and see my high school sweetheart, and he would come in and fail you for shit that, you know, was questionable. I don't know. It seemed to be part of the game. Anyway, I lost it. I'm crying. I'm irate. I'm screaming. And you came in, and I don't know if this is just I'm imagining things, but I saw, you know, the Marine that I regarded you to be, which is just all the positive things that I've already mentioned, but I saw you were like, in your eyes was like, I said something like, this sucks, man. Like, here I'm thinking about making a career out of this. Like, I love aspects of the Marine Corps, and this sort of bullshit is the stuff that makes people not want to stick around. I'm supposed to be out of my job here, and my company gunny is basically saying that you guys can't go off on your weekend. And anyway, I saw some empathy in your, or at least some sympathy in your eyes, and I was like, dude, how do you do this shit? You know, how do you stick around? How can I get to the point where I'm a Sergeant Suela, and if this is the sort of stuff that's gonna go on? And my room could have been fucked up. Who knows? I could have had a fucking giant turd in the toilet. But I mean, I felt at that moment like fucking games. All this, you know, it never.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you're out in the field all week, and you get home, and
yeah,
you just want to do. You want free time. You want free time. You need to relax, de-stress, because we play enough games out in the field. You know, why bring that back to your barracks? That's your house.
Right.
You want to get out of there and just, like you said, go see your girlfriend. And I understood all that stuff. Now, I got to the point where I didn't like playing games. And yeah, I had empathy and sympathy. And if you ask my wife today, though, I don't have much empathy, but I get dinged a lot from that on her. But back in the, I just wanted to, yeah, like you said, why would you want to stay around and go through all that crap and make a career out of it or stretch your time out when that's all you were seeing is
playing
games?
Yeah, and it to be like, and to be part of that process. And it also, it seems like when I talk to guys, like Oster was saying, and Grant, I don't know if you remember Grant, but those guys stayed in and wound up in the air wing, and they're talking about like, look, I'm proud to be a grunt. I'm glad my experience I selected 0311 because I had spoken to enough people that said, all right, this is the job, do it. You know, I'm like, all right, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to try. I had a buddy who went in open contract. He was a fucking air traffic controller, hated it. I had a guy who was radio guy. He despised it. You know, there were times when I didn't enjoy being in the grunts, but you know, overall, yeah, it was a very positive, memorable experience. But anyway, these guys said like, you know, as long as you do your job, you go home after hours, there's none of that bullshit. There's none of the games. So the notion of being even part of the process where it was my job, I understand you got to have things squared away and organized and all that stuff. But I mean, it would have been, it seemed to be like part of the mystique, part of the process was, you know, playing the guys used to call it fuck games. You know what I mean? Back to the back to the Butterbar lieutenant thing, picking up a new lieutenant. You talked about the tendency for them to want, obviously they're showing up to your unit, they're a boot, but they're also have had this extensive training, and they've that's in college, so they show up and they're supposed to be in command, capable, ready, and obviously they're paired up with a corresponding enlisted, senior enlisted, that's going to mentor them. But they often, like, there's a stereotypical boot lieutenant who, you know, can't run a compass and is always trying to, like, trying too hard a little bit. You have any stories about that or any thoughts on the, when the officers show up?
Well, when I was out of Fox Company 2-1 out in Pendleton, we had a lieutenant named Rector that showed up, and he was an older guy, an older lieutenant, as far as, you know, didn't go. But you mentioned the compass, and he always got us lost. So his nickname was Wrong Way Rector. So, yeah. I had some good lieutenants. Actually, one of the Lieutenant Katz out in California. He was good, muscular, great shape, and we lost him because he broke his femur playing rugby.
Ah, shit.
So, once I got to the East Coast, I was assigned H&S Company. I had a Lieutenant Anderson. He was the intel officer. Very smart guy, but no common sense.
Mm.
So that was a different animal because he wasn't in charge of the platoon. Then I got to 1-6. I had a Lieutenant Moran.
Mm.
He's a good guy. And then a Lieutenant Cooper. Cooper, I believe Cooper was one of my best lieutenants.
Yeah, he was great.
Besides the point where I told you earlier that's non-disclosed right now.
He's great. I remember something in the I mean, it's happened to all of us, but I remember something happened. We were out at, I think it was AP Hill, and we're on some crazy, crazy fucking 12-hour, like, night company or patrol or something. Anyway, we're doing training op in AP Hill, and the word was he got somebody turned around and hit him with a muzzle of his rifle and hit him in the head or something. They were taking a knee. But hey, we all have shit like that. But he was excellent. I agree. I thought that he was a great leader and a good man. And he
cared about his Marines.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what he did.
And his dad was a general, right?
Yep, yep. And I guess he's a big part of the Toys for Tots thing, I think.
Yes. Yes, I see him very active with that. So he looks like he's doing really well. I'm glad to hear that. And then our battalion commander, then, he was a good dude too. Robeson?
Robeson, Colonel Robeson. Yeah, I remember him.
Yeah. Now, his son, I saw something else. His son, I think he was at some point the battalion commander of 1-6 as well.
He came back and took that, huh?
His son is followed in his footsteps. Yeah, he was really phenomenal, that guy. I think that he was
high speed. He was the one that, with all that, all the room clearing stuff we did.
Yes.
The mountain stuff. He was really involved with that stuff.
Yeah. So.
And then, I guess, what do they call that platoon that during our float that went away? Like Riley and Watson went to it. And,
yeah, he was saying, Watson, I talked to Watson, he was saying MSPF.
Yeah, they took Riley went over there. Riley said they sent a lot of high speed training at that place, dealing with that stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like that's what I'm talking about. Like Watson was describing that was pretty. It seems like a highlight of his service. Like they had a different mission. They had something. There was some special things that they were doing. That I forget the name of the breakdown of the acronym, but he was pretty proud of being involved in that. They did a lot of cool shit. So cool. So then you get, so 1-6, we go to on the float, we come back in 95, you leave 1-6, where you get
out. And I got orders to 6th Marine Regiment, where that's where I finished out my time. And yeah, I came home.
And then you joined, at some point, you joined the Guard?
Yeah, I was out of the, not completely. I got out of the Staff Sergeant Select. I went back to the Marine Corps recruiter to see about getting back in. He said, yeah, we'll bring you back in as a Lance Corporal. And I said, you know what I said. So I did not do that. Then a recruiter from the National Guard got hold of my DD-214, called me up, and I joined the Guard like July 3rd of 96. So I was out maybe, 8 months, something like that. Joined the Guard, the Missouri National Guard, as a 92 Alpha Automated Logistical Specialist. Never got trained in it. And the opportunity came up for me to become a recruiter for the Army National Guard, which I jumped on because that's part of the AGR, Active Guard Reserve Program, just like being on active duty. I took that up, and I did that for 8.5 years, and I retired as a sergeant first class, 3-7, same equivalent, as a gunnery sergeant.
Yeah. And what was,
I did that.
What was your experience like in the Guard?
My experience, when I first got there, when I first reported to my first unit, I said, what the heck is this? These people, their uniforms were disheveled, their boots looked like crap. And you know me, I was always shiny boots and pressed out.
Yep.
And I saw these guys, and said, man, even my wife made fun of them when she saw them in uniform. It's like they've had these uniforms for like 20 years and didn't get new ones. So that's my first impression. I used to make fun of the National Guard when they came down to Camp Lejeune to train down there, seeing them on base walking around. But I got into the Guard unit, started dealing with the folks, and I realized that these guys are bringing a lot of skills from their civilian lives. Because, active duty guys, what do? That's all we do.
Right.
We live life and sleep as a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week grunt, or whatever MOS you are, doing nothing else. And then these guys bring all these skills to the unit that we can use, learn from them. And like I mentioned earlier, you see Marines, you see Air Force, you see Navy guys actually in the Coast or the National Guard.
Right.
Because it's another opportunity to get more time, more service to the country, more, and in this case, service to their states. And these guys, I'm impressed with them now. And like we mentioned earlier, National Guard deploys just as much as some active duty units.
Big time, yeah.
And you mentioned you were New Jersey Guard.
Yep.
So, and that's where you finished up your time?
Yes, yeah, my inactive service I did there, yeah. So it was pretty, it was a pretty good experience.
And I was a recruiter, so I got to put a lot of young folks in the Guard and give them opportunities, open doors. That's what I always told them. You're opening doors right now that you can't get anywhere else. And with a Guard, you're a federal unit, but your main thing is a state unit. You serve your state, earthquakes, tornadoes, natural disaster, all that stuff. You know the thing on that.
Oh, yeah.
So I enjoyed doing that. I felt bad in 2005, the unit I served, mainly recruited for, they got deployed to Iraq. A lot of young kids in that unit, and a lot of parents weren't happy with me. But it wasn't my fault. I told these kids, National Guard is military, girls, boys. So be prepared for different stuff.
Jeez.
And then I got out and retired, you talked about.
Yeah. And so there's something that we should talk about there, Sergeant Swale. One of the Marines that we served with back in the day, Joffrey Red, he was my roommate at one point. And were you saying that Riley had roomed with him as well?
I think maybe Riley did room with him.
Okay, so he was in our platoon. He was in our platoon, nonetheless, and good dude. A lot of great stories about Red. Now, Red had become in Memphis, right? He was a police officer.
Memphis Police.
Yeah. So tell the story about Red there, because you were there.
Well, Riley had called me and let me know that Red had been shot on duty down at some kind of library or something like that. He had been shot, but he was still in the hospital and still doing good, I guess, recovering. And then we got the word that he had passed away. And then they wanted us, somebody from the Marine Corps, his buddies, to come down and to be there for him and his family. We got the word out to everybody, basically in a platoon. I imagine majority of you guys knew about it. And Riley and I, since we were both there in Missouri, we're close to Memphis. We drove down there together. We got there tonight, and they did an outstanding. The police force, they shut down the highway, and they all the police cars had all their lights going, and driving through Memphis to honor Red, which was awesome. And then the next day, the funeral was scheduled, the service in the church. They asked us to say a few words, which Riley did an outstanding job. Riley knew Red better than I did, because you guys, of course, you know, you lived in rooms together.
Yeah.
You did all that stuff. I knew him as our platoon member, as a fellow Marine. And I know Red was always, it seemed to me like he was always quiet, but he was a PT stud.
Yeah.
He's a good man. And we said some nice words about him, and then I mentioned that he's up in heaven now serving at the Pearly Gates. So Red was a good Marine. I met his family, his wife. He hadn't been buried very long before he got killed. She was a very nice lady. She is a nice lady. She still texts me on our on Facebook, because she still holds Red's Facebook site.
Mm-hmm.
And then she updates all of us and different stuff with the family. But it was a very solemn occasion. Something I wouldn't want to go through anymore with any of my Marines. You guys, I know you're all younger and stuff, but I just pray to God that if you guys, if something happens to me, that you guys return the favor and come back and send me away.
Oh, so, absolutely, man. You know, that's one of the things. That's one of the things that I feel very strongly about doing this podcast is just having a conversation with people, again, about back in the day, that for most people that serve their time in service, as the years progress, it becomes even more and more special to them. And yet, you know, with the exception of one of the benefits of social media is that you can still be a part of somebody's life. You can, you know, like a picture of somebody, you know, somebody's had a grandchild or somebody's got a promotion, or you have a little bit of a window into what these individuals are up to now. Like Williamson, you know, for instance, Pudge Williamson, his son, you know, he and Rumpler and Chara and all these guys, we're all very tight, but Rumpler and Williamson, and we went through the same boot camp platoon, went through everything together. So we were like really, really among cohesive, brothers. We were even more tight. Anyway, his son is pitching for Ohio State. And, so to see that, you know, one example of like somebody, hey, somebody's doing good. I'm glad, you know, I'm happy to be in touch. So
yeah.
To have a conversation, to interface, to be in the loop so that the brotherhood can persist is important. And there's guys I know that I have spoken to that really have missed that brotherhood. They long for that that connection. And I feel like one of the things that the civilian sector does not really offer with maybe with the exception of some service organizations or, you know, I know I noticed about like rugby. I got my son played rugby for a while. People are into rugby. They're into it. You know, they're going to play until they friggin' fall over. But it's like you go at the end of a rugby match, you go to the bar and there's a mug with your name on it. It's like because you're part of something. And I feel like there's not a lot of things in this world that you can say that about, but the Marine Corps, the bond between brothers and those who serve is very, very special. And so there's been a couple occasions. I mean, Red is unfortunate, most recent loss.
Or and I know we lost some folks from Weapons Platoon too.
Yeah, man. His name escapes me, but we went, this is probably 10 years ago, but he was a machine gunner that you would remember, and Wilkerson.
Wilkerson.
Daniel Wilkerson. Yep. He was a machine gun section leader, I believe, and a real squared away dude, and funny as hell. He succumbed to cancer, and a bunch of us, me and Char, jumped in the car, went down there. Simultaneously, if you remember, in an adjacent platoon, I think third or first platoon, it was Todd Estep. He was dealing with some health concern for a while. We went down there at the same time. We kind of all were down there together and converging. Hack was there. All these people were. So I think that, you know, the podcast is going to go a long way to reconnect people and say, oh, yes, oh, Sergeant Suela. People say, oh, you know, it's so great to hear that guy's voice. I haven't heard him in 30 years. You know, glad to hear he's doing well. So they want to know. They remember you well. They want to know that you're doing well and that you remember them and these same experiences. And I feel like that our collective hearts are beating and we're living our lives wherever our lives are at. You know, I'm in Pennsylvania, Char is down the road in friggin' Maryland, Hack, you guys are out there in the Midwest, but that we can still maintain a connection and keep the memories alive and still serve by helping each other, and periodically reminiscing. So
I just recently reconnected with Sasser and Kyle. I found him on Facebook.
Yeah, isn't that great?
I look forever to find him, and the next thing he pops up, and there he is.
Yeah, yeah. That was great. I think Nunn told me. He's like, yeah. And he reached out to him, and then I saw that you're on there too. It's like that 1-6 1-6 Charlie Company to Pedro. So everybody's dropping their, you know, service. And then he said something like, you'll remember me, little guy.
Yeah.
And he's funny.
I love Seth Ryan Kyle. We got along great. And he gave me a lot of leadership skills and stuff too.
Yeah, he's great. We were fortunate to have a great platoon, great leadership. So it was a great time. So. Well, cool, man. Let me ask you some closing remarks here. Sergeant Suela, what does Semper Fidelis mean to you?
Semper Fidelis, always faithful, baby. That's, I go by that now, even in my civilian life. It means that I'm here for you always. If you need anything, call me, because I'm just a loyal Marine. And I want people, I expect the same from other people, to be faithful to me, because if I treat you good, I expect the same back from you.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a saying, but it binds us together. It keeps us together. That's why you walk by a Marine out in the field, you say, Semper Fidelis, or out in the civilian life, wearing a hat, Semper Fi, and they respond back to you. So it's good.
And what about the term esprit de corps?
Esprit de corps, baby. That's just it's a brotherhood. It's just we are involved with something bigger than all of us, and that corps bonded us together, kept us together. We've experienced things in our life that other people will never experience. Being places we shouldn't be at, but we went to, just to know, just to serve our country and to be there for our country, because someone's got to do it, and why not the 1%? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I love it, man.
And I'm proud to be a service member, proud to serve my Corps, the National Guard, Job Honor Bureau. I think it keeps me younger, Obi, dealing with people like today, 17-year, 18-year-old kids coming in there, and it keeps me going. I'm soon to be 60, and I feel like I'm maybe 40. So
that's awesome, man. What? Let me think. How can I end this in the most appropriate possible way? I'll just say this, my brother. You made a huge difference in my life. Serving under men like yourself and Staff Sergeant Cobbs and Lieutenant Cooper and a laundry list of other guys that were came before and after that. And it makes a difference. You were like, there's a term, force multiplier. I feel like you are a force multiplier. That is, you're allowing one Marine, let's say, in making a difference in his life to expand his capabilities exponentially to be the person that can be counted on and can charge the hill or, you know, breach this obstacle or perform this task within a Marine unit and allow us to all be better. The people out there that are in your category that I served with in the Marine Corps are many, and to be a force multiplier, man, to make a difference enough so that I want to go out there in being impacted by you, that I go off and I pay that forward by trying to make other people better and cultivating those same skills among the everyone I meet. Like you said, you know, you expect other people to operate the same way. Well, we all know in the civilian sector in this crazy world, it's not always the case. And so it makes it all that people are going to meet your expectations of them. People will let you down sometimes. So it's all the more special when you run across somebody who is as capable a leader as you have been for a lot of us. So I know that the guys are going to love to hear your voice, man, and to hear these stories, and maybe they'll learn some things that they just about the Sergeant Suela, that they, some of these details about your life, how you joined and the path that you took while you served. But I think they're going to enjoy this conversation. So with that being said, I wish you a safe trip to your destination, and have a great training there with your National Guard stuff. And Semper Fi, my brother.
Semper Fi, Obi. You're like my little brother. All of you guys.
Take care, my man. Yeah. Appreciate you. Easy.